Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for November the 13th, 2017. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, good evening there, David. And tonight we have plenty of veteran news. This past Saturday, as you know, Veterans Day, and in its recognition, we want to continue our past discussion about the sacrifices made by veterans, as well as the important topic of the full spectrum of the costs and effects of war, not only on veterans, but also on their families, society, and nation. As always, we welcome callers to participate in our show by calling in with comments and questions. Our toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Again, our toll-free call-in number for you to use to call in with your comments and questions is 1-888-627-6008. Hey, David, what's going on in Washington these days?
Well, there's been some interesting news I'd like to bring our listeners up to speed on. As you know, we just passed Veterans Day a week ago. Today, the VA Secretary, Dr. David Shulkin, he, during a speech at the National Press Club, he made what I think are some rather interesting and foretelling comments that veterans need to be paying attention to, because I think throughout the rest of the year and certainly into the next year and longer, this is a sign of what the VA administration may have in mind. And what he was talking about in his speech was basically a call to veteran groups to start thinking about a new approach to helping veterans that focuses more on promoting wellness and independence. Now, you might say, well, gee, who could disagree with that? That sounds like, you know, the American flag, mom, and apple pie. Who could disagree with that? But really, it's what you have to be putting his comments into context, and you'll see that there's really some other things that need to be recognized. What he said was he wants to see an ongoing dialogue with stakeholders about rationalizing veteran benefits. As he said, a veteran benefit advisory board that can clarify what we're trying to do for veterans and what's best and how we can do that in the best way. He said, and I quote, "We need more incentives for achieving wellness and independence. This should be a system that focuses on veterans' abilities, not on their disabilities. VA needs to transform into an organization where we are veterans' advocates. We facilitate them getting benefits, not being the gatekeeper of benefit decisions." And before I go further in quoting from his speech, let me just offer a few thoughts on what he said in just those few sentences. He wants to focus on veterans' abilities, not disabilities. Who can disagree with that? Makes sense. He wants to transform the VA into an organization where the veterans' advocates. Well, by law, that's what the VA employees on the benefit side are supposed to do already and have been obligated by law to do for many, many years, as well as facilitating veterans to get benefits. But, Richard, you and I know, in reality, that's not been the case. Now, what I think really needs to be focused on here is where Dr. Shulkin said, and I quote, he said, "Let me be clear, though, this is not about taking away benefits from veterans. This is about making benefits work better for veterans and transforming the Department of Veterans Affairs to do better for years and generations for future veterans. I think they deserve no less than that." If I could add kind of a word of caution, to me it sounds like he's picking his words carefully, that they don't want to take away benefits perhaps from veterans who are already receiving benefits, but at some point in the future, if legislation is passed through Congress, that they may be revamping the benefit program that will probably make it more difficult for veterans to get disability compensation and more difficult for veterans to keep disability compensation. In other words, the VA will be pressuring them essentially prove that that they are not getting better. And since we know the shortcomings, the problems facing the VA on the healthcare side and the treatment side, we know that it sounds like there could be a big burden put on the veterans. Richard, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, you know, my mind is just spinning when I see these words from Shulkin. You know, I mean, like you said, who can argue with those words? But you know, that's part of the problem. You can't argue with those words. But let's get down into the trenches and think about, you know, what are we doing to implement better benefit side for the veteran? And you know, I'm thinking about my personal opinion about the VA, which is that it's nothing more than a big insurance company. And what's the goal of most insurance companies, whether it's VA or a private insurance company? And that is not to pay. You know, they'll take in all the premiums that they can. As far as the VA is concerned, they'll send our men and women off to war. But when it comes time to finally pay up because of something that, you know, the harm that we have to our men and women, or pay up when a hurricane comes through Florida, the insurance companies don't want to do it. And the proof's in the pudding. And all you got to do is watch the way the VA compensates our veterans and how they shortchange them. And one of the things, David, you and I, as part of our philosophy when we're representing veterans, is to seek what we call individual unemployability, TDIU, which if a veteran has the right percentages for disabilities, i.e. you're at 70% for PTSD, and you can't get them up to 100%, but you might be able to get them to 100% by individual unemployability. And most of the time, David, you and I have been successful in that strategy. But that strategy also works for the VA, because now, yes, they're compensating the veteran at 100%, he's being paid at 100%. However, because it's the individual unemployability that gets him up to 100%, that can be taken away at a later date. He's only getting the 70% for the PTSD, so he's not 100% for his disability. So if down the road the veteran who would be subject to further review examination, it's very possible that he could end up losing that unemployability compensation, and then he's back to 70%.
Yeah, and if I could add there, Richard, about the unemployability, about 6 months ago, our listeners may recall that the VA, as part of the budget process, had thrown in a proposal that once a veteran reached the age of 62, eligible for Social Security, that Social Security retirement, that the veteran's eligibility for what's known as TDIU, total disability based on individual unemployability, it's also called IU for individual unemployability, would end. Well, we thought that would be extremely unfair to veterans who may have been out of the workforce for many years or even decades because of their military service-connected related disabilities, and therefore they had not paid much into the Social Security retirement system, and therefore their Social Security retirement check would be, you know, a very small amount compared to what it would have been if they'd been able to work for all those years. And there was a huge outcry by veterans groups that the VA backed off. But you could see what the VA was trying to do. It's all about money. And there are even some veteran groups that are really taking the side of the VA and trying to save money. And we'll see where this goes. But I think Dr. Shulkin's speech from a week ago should really be a cautionary event. Veterans need to pay attention to what he's really trying to say. And, you know, the context of what he was saying was that there really has never been a full systematic review of veteran benefits, and the previous administrations haven't thought about the financial impact or other problems created by the expansion of benefits. Well, that's pretty clear. Those words are also pretty clear that now they're concerned about, you know, how much money they're having to pay. And true, it's a lot of money. In 1980, for instance, the VA paid disability benefits of $13.7 billion in 1980. Well, fast forward 37 years to this year, and the department will be spending just over $95 billion on those benefits. Also, the Veteran Benefit Administration, the side of the VA that deals with disability claims, their administrative costs have gone up from $1 billion a year in the year 2000 to $5 billion in the year 2017. So in the course of 17 years, going from $1 billion to $5 billion. So the VA is obviously concerned about it. Congress is concerned about it. There are some members of Congress concerned about it. You know, we are living in an era where our national government is $20 trillion in debt. That's 20 with 12 zeros after it, dollars in debt. And certainly that is going to have an impact if lawmakers are serious about addressing that problem, as well as the annual deficit problem. So we'll see. Dr. Shulkin, in his speech, also mixed in some other things that we've talked a lot about. We've talked about the complexity of the disability claim system, the complexity and the long delay of the disability appeal system, and he touched on those in his speech, too. He said, quote, "We have to make simpler benefit determinations. Frankly, we're spending too much on administrative costs, and we have to let veterans know what they can expect. They shouldn't have to constantly be refiling claims to get what they deserve. We have to emphasize service connection for disabilities so we aren't compensating veterans for age-related issues. We have to focus benefits on enabling independence so veterans can succeed on their own, because that's what I think leads towards feeling a sense of well-being," unquote. So there's a lot there, and it really is, he's talking about some tough issues that have essentially been ignored. They've been issues that have been hiding in plain sight, and now they're finally receiving some attention, I think mostly motivated for financial reasons. They say in Washington, follow the money, see the impact of money, and now we're seeing it with the VA. Not terribly surprising, perhaps, but it's something that the veterans need to look at. Yeah, is there room for improvement? Is there room for some reform? I'd say yes, there is, but the question is, are they going to overdo it, essentially, and hurt veterans that justifiably need help, and put too much of a burden on these veterans. So, over to you, Richard. I know you have some other news about.
No, one thing back on Shulkin's speech here is, you know, I wish he would put some language in there about and some thoughts behind what we can do to improve the benefit side and the compensation side for these vets. And, you know, we were on the radio the other day down in Tampa, WMNF 88.5, and Rob Lori, you know, he had asked me if, you know, what thoughts I had, and one of the things that I mentioned was putting in a mediation system, which you have in civilian courts, you know, in every civilian court in the United States. And you also have it in the criminal courts and the family law courts. There's a mandatory mediation process, and it was initiated in order to speed up the calendar and remove the backlog. If the VA would implement something like this, well, I can't even begin to believe how fast we could start getting rid of that backlog of 450,000 cases that are pending. It's not hard to do. It's about communication. And David, you and I have seen this with some of the decision review offices in St. Pete that pick up the phone and they call us. And they ask, how can we get rid of this case? And we sit there and, you know, I open up my file, they open up their file, and within a half hour, we have the darn thing resolved. It doesn't take much, but, you know, in all these words of wisdom from Shulkin, you know, I don't see anything like that that can move the system along. But then again, he's not a lawyer. He's a doctor, and he's not thinking about some of the common sense things that that we can do to help move this case and all this legislation that's out there. That's great stuff, but you know, you get a bunch of litigators together, and I guarantee you, you could start helping to come up with some good ideas how to move the system. But and that kind of segues me into the other big news about the VA's disability benefits appeal system. Which they call the Rapid Appeals Modernization Program, or RAMP, which lets veterans choose from multiple different paths to resolve pending claims. So here's one of the quote-unquote solutions that Congress is trying to come up with. The VA began the 18-month implementation plan when President Donald Trump signed the Veterans Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act into law in August of this year. This created a new claims review process. The goal of RAMP is to give veterans the earliest possible resolution of their pending claims with the VBA. The new legislation creates three options for veterans dissatisfied with the initial claims with the initial decisions on their claims. So listen carefully. They can seek higher level review by a regional office on the same evidence presented to the original claims processor. In other words, they can submit new evidence or have a hearing, which to me suggests a very high likelihood of the same bad decision being rubber stamped, particularly since the new legislation removes the VA's current legal duty to assist veterans after an initial decision. And a low-level VA employees will be the ones making the decisions on review. They can file a supplemental claim with a regional office that would include the opportunity to submit additional evidence, which to me means just one more time spinning around the hamster wheel trying to guess what will be enough evidence to satisfy the VA. Or three, they can appeal directly to the Board of Veterans Appeals, resulting in a possible hearing and or the opportunity to submit additional evidence. The BVA would have two separate tracks for appeals. Those cases where the veteran doesn't want a hearing and doesn't want to submit new evidence, which supposedly will be the faster of the two tracks, or cases in which the veteran wants a hearing and wants to submit new evidence, which likely will still involve years of waiting. The problem is the legislation does nothing to fix the current backlog between 450,000 and 500,000 claims currently unappealed. The legislation does nothing to boost the number of VA employees handling claims and appeals. The system clearly needs to be reformed, but in my opinion, this legislation will just replace one flawed system with another flawed system. Sorry to be the bearer of the bad news, veterans, but that's how I see it. Dave, back to you.
Yep, another news from Washington regarding the issue of reforming and improving the VA healthcare system. The VA has about 40,000 job vacancies, most of those on the healthcare side of the VA as opposed to the benefits side of the VA. An ongoing issue is how to provide timely care to veterans, whether in the VA system or the private health care system. So in the next month and then most likely continuing into the new year, you should see more activity in Washington as Congress, the VA, and veteran groups discuss the details of some plans that would not only replace the current so-called Veterans Choice Program that allows veterans to seek medical care certain circumstances in the private sector, but that plan will also supposedly enable the VA to modernize large parts of its rather vast healthcare system. The plan, which the VA has titled Veterans Care, and you know, in the ways of Washington, you have to throw some acronyms in there. So when they call it the Veterans Care Act, the word care stands for Coordinated Access and Rewarding Experiences. We'll see how that actually matches with reality. But the Veterans Care Act was unveiled week before last, and has an overall structure that most major veteran groups applaud, mostly because they helped to shape it. They don't like everything in it, though, so you're going to have the House and the Senate Veteran Affairs Committees. They're expected to offer their own replacements very soon, maybe to have more safeguards and more details on how to improve access to care the veteran groups claim are not addressed yet in the VA plan. A sign of some controversy is that some officials from the largest federal workers union have criticized the plan as, quote, a total dismantling of the department, unquote, that would jeopardize veteran services. J. David Cox, Sr., the national president of the American Federation of Government Employees, was quoted in a recent Military Times article as saying, quote, it's taking resources out of the VA and shifting them into the private sector. It's voucherizing veterans' health care, unquote. Well, no doubt veterans will want to follow this story as the events unfold in Washington over the next month. On a related note, I don't know how many of our listeners saw Rick Burns' recent documentary on PBS. It screened this past Monday, November 6th. We had Rick Burns on our show to be interviewed 2 Mondays ago. His documentary was called VA, The Human Cost of War. And for those of you who missed it, it should be available for purchase pretty soon on PBS.org. The film discussed the workings of the VA, discussed some of its history. It had interviews with a past VA secretary, the current VA secretary, some veteran organization representatives, members of Congress, veteran family members, and others, basically examining the kind of care. But, Richard, as you and I talked about after we both saw the show last Monday night, it focused almost entirely on the healthcare side. It mentioned very little about the issues, the problems with the benefits side. But it's a very important topic, and we'll see what changes will be produced by Congress in the near future to change and allegedly reform the VA. So that's news from what's going on in Washington, D.C. with the VA. Rick, I understand you've got some more info on the open burn pit issue for us.
Yep, that's another important issue affecting thousands of veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan concerning the open burn pits, which were used by the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, and have caused lung diseases and various kinds of cancer to troops stationed near those pits. On September 11th, on our September 11th show, we had an interview with film director and producer Greg Lovett. His latest film is on the burn pits issue, entitled Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How American Poisoned Its Soldiers. This film deals with the important issue of open burn pits commonly used in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which now are suspected of causing large numbers of veterans to suffer very serious health problems due to numerous toxic substances which were incinerated in those huge burn pits. To find out more about the film, check it out on Facebook by typing in the words burn pit documentary in the Facebook search engine. The premiere showing of this film was in Los Angeles on October the 9th, and future screenings are scheduled over the next couple of months across the nation. The schedule can be found on the website tug.com, as well as the Facebook page for the Burn Pits documentary. Go to Facebook and type in Burn Pits documentary in the search engine. We have a screening of this film on October 19th in Tampa, Florida, and again on Wednesday, November 1st in Brandon, Florida. Which David and I attended, and I must say, you know, one of the things that I mean, there were so many things about that film that just was enlightening to me. You know, even with someone who has sat with veterans who've experienced the burn pits, and they would tell me about their exposure. But even when they told me what they went through, their words really didn't put it in perspective for me. And then when I saw this film, I was just horrified to see what these men and women have been exposed to. And, you know, one of the things, David, that I'm thinking about is the fact that, you know, there was money to build incinerators over there, which would have been used instead of these burn pits. And for whatever reason, the companies that were going to put the burn pits never put them in.
Yeah, if I could add something, Richard, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if I could just add something, because our listeners may be wondering, well, if we're complaining about the burn pits where they're burning things, and you've mentioned these incinerators as a solution, the key is that the incinerators would be very high-temperature incinerators that would incinerate the waste in a little more environmentally safe manner. In other words, those incinerators would be releasing less of these toxic pollutants into the air. If you saw the film, Richard, as you were saying, if you saw the film, you would see that some of these installations, there was so much of this toxic smoke generated that it created essentially a standing cloud, like a fog, over and surrounding these pits. And one of these pits, at one of the largest bases, was 10 acres in size, and it was burning 24 hours a day, burning every imaginable kind of garbage, metals, woods, human waste, batteries, you name it, they were burning it. And
there was one scene there, David, where there was a truck, like a dump truck, just backing up into the pit that was already smoldering and it was on fire, and just dumping whatever was on the back of that truck right into that pit, and then driving away. So, I remember talking to one veteran, and he was talking to his commander, and the commander was saying, just, take all that stuff and burn it, just burn it. And this guy was a contractor, and he turned to his commander and said, I don't think we should be putting all this stuff in there. I mean, this is highly toxic stuff. And his commander said, that's, I'm in charge, and this is what you're supposed to do, so just, go do it. Then they dump gasoline on this stuff and let it on fire. As this one veteran said to me one time, when the burn pit was really going, you got that black smoke out there. If it was a beautiful sunny day, you couldn't see the sun.
And sometimes, depending on what the toxic substance is, the smoke wasn't always black. It might be blue or some other color. But if our listeners can get a chance to see the film, it's definitely worth it. Check out TUGG.com. Check out Facebook, and hopefully it will be available soon for.
And the other thing about, and we've said this a few times, and why it's important for our listeners to go see this film, is that this is this generation's Agent Orange. And just like dealing with Agent Orange in Vietnam, when these veterans came back with all these different diseases and disabilities, the connection between the Agent Orange and disability took decades for the VA to finally rectify the situation and grant these service-connected disabilities to our veterans. Well, hopefully we're not going to have the same problem with our veterans who've been exposed to burn pits. There was that one doctor, I think, out of Nashville, David, who was one of the first doctors to really notice what was going on, and I think his name is Dr. Miller. And then didn't they take him, didn't they stop sending him cases or something like that, David?
Yeah, the Army stopped after he started making reports that the military did not like. And his conclusions were basically that, they did tests, including lung biopsies, and they discovered, chronic restrictive bronchiolitis caused by toxic substances that were tearing the fine lining of the lungs. These were injuries that were not being caught or detected by X-rays, by other types of tests. And for a while, the military, at least some of the military, were claiming that the that the soldiers and the veterans' symptoms were psychosomatic, you know, that they were basically in their mind. But these were young people, you know, in their 20s. They had gone over to Iraq and Afghanistan healthy, obviously, or they would not have been allowed to deploy. They come back after a year or sometimes multiple deployments, and their health is failing. They can't pass their physical test. They can't do their run. You know, they can't run without respiratory problems. And finally, this doctor at Vanderbilt University, reached the conclusions that these respiratory illnesses were caused by exposure to toxic substances, and then connect the dots of what exposure was that? Well, these humongous open burn pits. There are literally hundreds of them around the country, but five of the largest in particular have been singled out, and they happen to be installations that when the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein was in control of the country, those five major installations had been known storage sites for Iraqi chemical weapons, bases that the U.S. bombed the daylights out of and then essentially took over after the invasion, but never did soil samples to see what might have been in the soil. They started using these open burn pits of many acres, some even 10 acres in size. They were burning 24 hours a day. So this documentary, it's called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers, is very important if you get a chance to see it. And I think that the discussion needs to continue. And for our listeners wondering, well, okay, so what's the point? What's the goal? Well, one of the goals is to make sure that the VA and the military acknowledge what's going on and start treating these soldiers and veterans properly, getting them the health care they need for these diseases. It includes not only respiratory diseases, but also a number of cancers. And a number of these veterans have already died. So they need the proper medical care, treatment, diagnosis, and the other part of it would be on disability compensation, that they need to create a presumption of service connection for a list of these respiratory diseases and at least certain cancers that doctors would say would be linked to the exposure to these toxic substances. And on a very practical level, when people wonder, well, what's the medical evidence? Think of it this way. These open burn pits, at least burning the type of materials that are being burned in Iraq and Afghanistan, would be illegal in the United States. It would violate environmental, federal and state environmental laws. And in fact, and why? You ask yourself, well, why is it? Why do these environmental laws exist? It's to protect people's health, basically. So why would people think that just because they create these open burn pits on the other side of the planet, that somehow they're not going to cause the same health problems to human beings? You know, common sense needs to apply here. And then the other part of it is there's a whole other layer of issues involving these burn pits, and that is, you know, the judgment of the U.S. government, the military, in overseeing these burn pits, which at least some of them were operated by a government contractor, KBR, which formerly was a subsidiary of Halliburton. And under the contract between the military and KBR, it said very clearly that they were to comply with U.S. EPA environmental rules per the contract, even though those rules would not extend to Iraq and Afghanistan, that under the contract they were contractually obligated to do that. And they clearly were not doing that. And their excuse was, well, we were doing what the military told us, and therefore it's the military's fault for not overseeing us, seeing them properly. Well, the reality is one of the reasons that the government was contracting these services out was because they didn't have the personnel in uniform to do that. They didn't have uniform, you know, service members to do that, number one, and number two, that they didn't have the expertise to be overseeing it. That's why they hired these contractors. And in the film, U.S. Senator Udall said, he was interviewed and said that, you know, they had the money. They, meaning the military and the contractors, had the money to buy these high-temperature enclosed incinerators, which would more safely, relatively more safely, incinerate all this waste and garbage. And they just did not use the money. They, you know, keep in mind that this was going on for many years after the invasion. So some people might say, well, hey, you know, this is wartime. Every war, you know, armies have burnt their garbage in open air pits or fields. Yes, but we're talking about a much longer war now, and you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And even as recently as 2013, some of these pits were still operational. You know, that's 10 years after the Iraq invasion of 2003. So it's just another example, you know, of the things that go wrong in war. As what's interesting too is in this film, some of the soldiers that were interviewed, they said, yeah, we knew we were going to war. There was a chance of dying or getting killed in battle or getting killed by these IEDs. But what they didn't expect was that their own force, their own government, was going to essentially poison them with these open burn pits and then deny them proper care and benefits afterwards. And in the film, they also interview some veteran families. One family had incurred like $250,000 in medical bills that the military and the VA did not cover to treat his cancer when he came home. In any event, check that film out. Before we move on to another topic, Rick, you want to add anything further on this burn pit documentary issue?
No, I think we're going to be talking about this for quite a while, David. I doubt the VA is going to do much to help our veterans in that particular area with the burn pit exposure. In the near future, hopefully over time, they'll finally, you know, get on the ball and do something, like, again, just like the Agent Orange issue with our Vietnam vets. So we'll continue to watch it. And veterans, if you're out there and you were exposed to the burn pits, make sure you get to your veteran service officer or your attorney and that you put in your claim. Because, you know, eventually... they have to recognize that this exposure has caused you numerous, numerous disabilities. David, why don't you tell us about the human cost of war?
Yeah, this is an issue that we talked about on our September 25th show here on BBS Radio, and also that you and I talked about when we were on WMNF in Tampa, Florida this past Friday, and that's the issue of, you know, the full spectrum of the death, destruction, and other harm and cost of war. In human terms, social terms, financial terms, political terms, international relations, and everything, the full gamut. On September 25th, we interviewed two of the co-directors of Brown University's Cost of War Project, Professor Catherine Lutz of Brown University and Professor Nita Crawford of Boston University. And you can go back. One of the great things about BBS Radio is that they archive all our shows, so our listeners can go back and listen to our September 25th show. It was great interviews of Professor Catherine Lutz and Professor Nita Crawford, and they're co-directors of the Cost of War Project, and they lead a team of literally several dozen scholars, experts in various fields, human rights practitioners, doctors. They began their work in 2011, which was, you know, the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11, and their purpose was to do research to promote greater awareness and understanding, and promote discussion about the costs of the post 9/11 wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and then the related wars or violence in Pakistan in Syria. They have a website which is costsofwar.org, costsofwar.org. I urge our listeners to check that out. There are many hidden or if not hidden, there are basically unacknowledged costs of the United States' decision to respond to the 9/11 attacks with military force and to continue with the use of military force now more than 16 years after 9/11, with really no end in sight as far as this endless war against terrorism. Now, no one's going to be naive and say that actions should not be taken to defend the United States and its citizens from acts of terror. But the point is, what's the effective way to do that? The effective way to do it, and what does it really mean when you say we're going to have this war on terror with all the implications as far as human costs, human lives destroyed, economic, financial, political costs? It needs to be examined. There needs to be a far better discussion about these issues. There needs to be better informed public policies made by leaders in Washington. So what we presented, and what doctors Catherine Lutz and Nita Crawford of the Cost of War Project presented in our September 25th show, was some of their insights. And we hope that they'll be back on our show at some point in the near future. Both have done a lot of research on these issues, and we will welcome their further insight. And as an aside, Richard, as if you and I aren't busy enough, we're adding to our projects. You and I are going to be working on making sure that there is a world-class documentary film made on these issues, and you and I will announce more of the details in upcoming shows on what's going on. But we're in the preparatory stages of that, and I'm sure the Cost of War Project will be instrumental in sharing their research and their analysis on these issues. But I know we've got about 13 minutes left in our show, Rick, and we don't have time for all these.
Before we go on that, let's throw out some numbers here that I think people, when we talk about cost of war, people should really, the proof's in the pudding here. Approximately 370,000 people have been killed by direct war violence in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. The number of people who have been wounded or have fallen ill as a result of the conflict is far higher, as is the number of civilians who have died indirectly as a result of the destruction of hospitals and infrastructure and environmental contamination. Thousands of United States service members have died in combat, as have thousands of civilian contractors. Many have died later on from injuries and illnesses sustained in the war zone. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers and contractors have been wounded and are living with disabilities and war-related illnesses. Allied security forces have also suffered significant casualties, as have opposition forces. Here are more key findings by the Cost of War Project. Over 6,900 U.S. troops have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, as have approximately 7,000 contractors. Over 970,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veteran disability claims have been registered with the VA. By conservative estimate, approximately 43,000 allied troops and police have died, and over 75,000 have been wounded. However, the vast majority of people killed are Afghan, Pakistani, and Iraqi civilians. At least 200,000 civilians have been killed in fighting. Millions of people living in the war zones have also been displaced by war. To date, 10.1 million Afghans, Pakistanis, and Iraqis are living as war refugees in other countries or are displaced from their homes. I mean, these are real, real numbers. And it's not going to get any better if we don't start addressing, as the program's called, the cost of war. Back to you, David.
Yes, and I think... although there have been films made about cost of war in specific compartmentalized areas, like Rick Burns just did a film on VA, the human cost of war, but he was examining, disabled American veterans and that narrow scope. But the cost of war looks at it not just as far as U.S. troops that have been killed or wounded, and that's not to minimize the tragedy of their losses, but to also realize when we go to war, we're talking about entire countries, societies, and in this case, hundreds of thousands of civilians that have been killed in the fighting, and over 10 million people that have are war refugees. They're now in other countries, or they're essentially displaced from their homes, but still living in their home countries. So, I think many people, but I'm not going to concede that all people, but many people recognize, yeah, war is hell. That's the old saying. But how bad is it really? What's the full spectrum of the costs and the harm? I don't think most people think about it. You know, there's an old saying, Rick, that you and I have heard from some of our clients, you know, when the country goes to war, the Marines go to war and America goes to the shopping mall. And certainly after 9/11, starting with President Bush at that time, was encouraging people, just go back and return to your normal routine. You know, it's as if once 9/11 was once we started recovering from that and the military started their wars, it was encouraging most Americans not to think about it. They were not made, most Americans were not asked to make any sort of a sacrifice in any way unless they're in the military or their family members, those in the military. It wasn't like World War II where the whole country was essentially making sacrifices in their daily lives and affecting them with rationing and other things. It wasn't like that at all. These two wars were put on essentially the national credit card when the country's already in debt. But basically, the point of the Cost of War Project is to increase knowledge and awareness of these things. And also, here's the next step, the most important step beyond that. It's very important they recognize the full extent of war and the harm. But the next step is, how do you apply this knowledge to examine non-military alternatives to dealing with terrorism and to hold those accountable who are responsible for perpetrating 9/11 attacks and also the post 9/11 terrorist acts? And these alternatives that need to be examined, they need to be examined as far as will they be effective in protecting America, but doing so in a way that's less costly in human lives without going to war, as we've done, and without also creating the huge financial losses that are going along with these wars. So, you know, it's interesting, recently in September, Rick Burns' brother, Ken Burns, was one of the co-producers of a very long series about the Vietnam War. Well, the highlight of the worst part of the Vietnam War was 67, 68. That's now 50 years ago, and now they're still talking about Vietnam War. They need to be, our point is that they need to be examining the Iraq and Afghanistan situation now. We're already, you know, 16 years into Afghanistan War. 14 and a half years into the Iraq War, and need to be examining it now, and what lessons can we learn, and how can current policy decisions be improved. But there's a lot to it, and I could go on if we have the time. But before we wrap up tonight, Rick, why don't you share with us your further thoughts and any of the other information and statistics that we have on these issues.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking, David, when you were talking about the Rick Burns, the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam, 50 years. I mean, we're still getting veterans compensated for Vietnam. I mean, we're still, the cost of Vietnam is still ongoing.
Right.
It's just amazing. It's just, I don't know. It's not the answer. It's not the solution, because all it's doing is causing more heartache, not just in this country, but around the world. But we have our usual programs that we want to mention for our veterans. The first one is Coaching into Care. If you are a family member of a veteran who has left the service and is having a tough time transitioning to student life, please be aware of the VA's program called Coaching into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veterans. Give the program a call. The number is toll-free 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's coaching into care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Again, that number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Yes, and that really is another reminder of another ongoing cost of war, and that is, you know, so many veterans come home from the war and they're suffering, psychological harm from what they experienced over there. And right now the VA has admitted that in the order of 20 to 22 veterans are dying by suicide every day. So whenever we mention every week the Coaching into Care program and the crisis line, it's for a good reason. And we hope listeners will get the word out about that. But that's a very serious consequence of war that even many people don't think about. You know, Richard, you mentioned the statistic earlier that in the last 16 years, 6,900 American soldiers, other service members that died in the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. That's not counting the ones that came home and died by suicide because of untreated or improperly treated post-traumatic stress disorder or from other disabilities, like we're seeing those that are dying from respiratory and other cancers from the toxic exposure. But before we wrap up tonight, I also want to mention that next week on our show we're going to have John B. Wells, who's the director of an organization called Military Veterans Advocacy. He was on our show earlier this year, and we hope to have him back next week. He's a Navy, retired Navy officer, as well as an attorney. He's a very skilled advocate for veterans issues, representing veterans, but also representing veteran groups, including lobbying members of Congress. And some of the issues he'll talk about will include Agent Orange-related issues affecting Navy veterans, affecting veterans who served on Guam. He'll be talking about the impact of the new appeals reform legislation, which was signed into law in August of this year. He'll talk about some of the toxic exposure issues that we touched on earlier tonight, as well as other issues of interest to veterans. So hope everyone will tune in next week. It should be a good show with John Wells, the Executive Director of Military Veterans Advocacy. As we close tonight, we'd like to recognize our show sponsors, which include American Legion Post 303 of Bonita Springs, Florida, Mr. Charles M. Newman of Florida, and Corey and Hurley Law Group, which represents veterans and disability cases involving the VA. You can find out more about the law firm at the law firm's website, which is CoreyandHurleyLawGroup.com. We'd like to thank our producer here at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. We'd like to invite listeners to become show guests if they're interested, or show sponsors and advertisers. Our contact information is on our show's website, which is bbsradio.com/TheVeteransNewsHour. You can also find archived podcasts of our prior shows for your benefit, and hope you'll enjoy listening to those. As we close, I ask you to please tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, hope you have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.